Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Josh Ruxin, who is director of the Health Builders in Rwanda. Dr. Ruxin has extensive experience operating at the intersection of public health, business, and international development. In 1996, he joined Monitor Group, and during his years at the Monitor Group, Dr. Ruxin led projects in several developing countries and was an advisor to government and private sector leaders on business strategy and economic development. He's the author of A Thousand Hills to Heaven, Love, Hope, and a Restaurant in Rwanda. Welcome to Background Briefing, Josh Ruxin.
Thank you so much.
And you're on your way back to Kigali, and on Monday, Rwanda launched a week of official mourning to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the massacres, which left more than 800,000 people, mostly Tutsis and moderate Hutus, dead at the hands of Hutu extremists and a number of world leaders. Tony Blair, Thabo Mbeki from South Africa, have come to official ceremony. The French, of course, are conspicuously absent, having been told not to show up. At least the French ambassador was told not to show up. Just give me a sense about what's happening there on the ground. Is this a country that is healing?
Oh, absolutely. So I've actually lived in Rwanda with my family for nearly a decade, and we've had the unique opportunity to watch as this country, who most prognosticators thought was going to fail, actually succeed. And although this, of course, does mark an incredibly sad time 20 years after the horrendous genocide, on the other hand, it's also a time of great optimism because 20 years out, the country's economic growth is fantastic. Health outcomes are dramatically improved. The entire country actually looks different than it did 20 years ago. There's roads going everywhere, much improved access to electricity, water. It's really one of the very few places in sub-Saharan Africa that is getting the basics right for all people.
And the health ministry apparently have done a survey in Rwanda saying that one in three children still have post-traumatic stress disorder from the extraordinary violence, where quite often within families, Hutus murdered Tutsis, even if they were married. I imagine the psychological scars are so profound that it's not surprising. But what's your sense of, if on the surface everything is working economically, etc., what about inside the hearts and minds of the people?
Well, I think 10 years ago, the country looked quite a bit different, and the psychological scars were more visible on people's faces and in their demeanor. I think today, with nearly half the population having been born after the genocide, and certainly the vast majority having no recollection of the genocide, it really is a country on the move where they're not looking back, they're looking forward. Now, of course, back in the countryside and in areas where people suffer terribly from the genocide and yet have not reaped terrific opportunities, there's still a lot of time to focus on the past. But I would say that in terms of PTSD, it's no national epidemic, and it's something that certainly is very rarely seen.
Yeah, in fact, let me just re-quote that the health ministry said that close to one-third of adult Rwandans still exhibit symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, according to a 2011 report from the health ministry. So in terms of the international gathering there, of course, the United States is represented by UN Ambassador Samantha Power, who won a Pulitzer Prize for her book about the U.S. failures to respond to genocides in Rwanda and in the former Yugoslavia. I mentioned Tony Blair and Thabo Mbeki. Also, the head of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, basically said that the UN feels deep remorse for having failed to stop the genocide. One of the things that is so extraordinary is that how, looking back, and even at the time, I think it was pretty clear that so few peacekeepers could have kept the peace. What's your sense of the collective guilt of the West in that regard?
Well, I've actually had the opportunity living in Rwanda to talk to a number of military advisors and others who have sort of deconstructed the genocide. And the pervasive view is that, first of all, the forces on the ground could have done much more and could have saved a lot more people. And with relatively light increases in support, perhaps two-thirds or greater portion of the genocide and the genocide victims could have been avoided. So it really is unfortunately a stain on the West that this was not stopped. When my wife and I moved to Rwanda nearly a decade ago, one of the things that she found were genocide survivors without jobs. And one of the reasons she decided to develop a restaurant and hospitality training center was to create jobs for those very same victims. And in fact, Samantha Power was in Heaven Restaurant last night with a huge delegation. And I think it was quite a somber, but again, optimistic affair in the sense that everyone gets to see how far Rwanda has come in spite of the lack of support 20 years ago.
So going back to the killings that were triggered on April the 7th in 1994, when a plane carrying the president of Rwanda and Burundi's Hutu president as well was shot down near Kigali Airport. And that triggered this extraordinary bloodletting, where the media radio programs, of course, urged Hutus to kill Tutsis, calling them cockroaches. Neighbors attack neighbors, teachers kill students. And as mentioned about, you know, intermarriage between the two groups, husbands handed over wives to be killed, etc. So it was a horrendous bloodletting. But has anybody ever gotten to the bottom of what triggered it? And I know, of course, Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda, blames the French in many ways for somehow being behind the chicanery that led to the shoot down of the plane. Conversely, a French judge has blamed Paul Kagame for shooting down the plane. So what do we know about what triggered that event?
Well, I don't think that we know enough to actually conclusively state who shot down the plane. You just elucidated what the two sides are. I think what we do know for sure is that from 1959 to 1994, with Belgian and French support, Hutu power led pogroms, massacred thousands and thousands of people, and launched a propaganda campaign that over the course of many decades was the real groundwork for the genocide. And this is part of the story that is often missing, is that people think that, oh, the genocide happened because the plane went down and it occurred over 100 days, when in fact there had been a civil war that was already occurring between 1990 and 1994, and the genocide was really the culmination.
So were there colonial fingerprints on that? Were the French supporting one tribe, the Hutu, and were the British supporting the other, the Tutsi? I mean, those were common colonial games. In many ways, we're enduring the legacy of the French colonial experiment in Syria, where they empowered the minority Alawite community, gave them the power to hold down the majority. So was there colonial chicanery in this tribal politics?
Absolutely, because the tribes as they stand did not really exist until colonization. And it was the colonists who basically determined who was Tutsi and who was Hutu in the first place, very frequently by counting the number of cows that someone had. And then that really essentially empowered the group that was identified as Tutsis until 1959. Then in 1959, with independence, the tables were turned and Hutu power rose up and really made Tutsis second-class citizens in their own country. And throughout that entire period, 1959 to 1994, there was extensive support, including military support, from European powers.
And what's explained the ability of the Tutsis to come back with Kagame and recapture the country after so many, 800,000 of their brethren had been massacred? Where did Kagame get his forces from? And the impression one gets is that so many people were killed. Where was he able to find this Tutsi army to come back and retake the country?
It's actually a remarkable story that's not told enough, but actually is studied at West Point, which is that Paul Kagame and his best friend, Fred Guigema, starting in the 1980s, began building a shadow army called the Rwanda Patriotic Army within the Ugandan military. And in 1990, when this was nearly discovered, and by that time they had several thousand troops, they launched an attack on Rwanda to liberate Rwanda. And that was the beginning of the civil war. And again, eventually they had fought Hutu power to a standstill, and when Hutu power saw that it was losing, that was and was going to have to power share, that was when the genocide happened.
So after the in July the 4th is when the RPF under Kagame controlled Kigali, but then that led to a counter massacre, didn't it? And then the Hutus are then driven into the Congo, which has been destabilized ever since.
Well, it's certainly true that the Rwandan military, or I should say the RPF, RPA forces, chased the genocidaire into Congo. And indeed, that is really one of the leading causes of the horrors that have occurred in Congo. I would suggest that there are a lot of other causes as well. And there was certainly terrible instability in eastern Congo before 1994, but it was certainly wildly exacerbated by this drive of the genocidaire into eastern Congo, and it continues to be a melting pot of all sorts of militia groups, including those few genocidaire who still reside in eastern Congo.
So there has been a genocide fugitive tracking unit that have issued a number of arrest warrants of these genocidaires living in Europe and Canada and the United States. Apparently the most prominent one, or the highest level, or I guess the most wanted, is apparently living in Kenya under protection of Kenya's leaders, and that is the businessman who supposedly, the Hutu businessman who allegedly bankrolled the genocide, Felicien Kabuga. Do you know anything about him?
No, I don't, actually. I try to focus much more on the present and the future of Rwanda than on the past, and don't get overly caught up in the tracking of these very terrible figures. But I can say that the Rwandan government does rightly place tremendous resources on forcing the international community to do finally what's right all these years later.
Well, they've had, for 2 million people have gone through what do they call gachachas. So explain what they are about.
Well, the gachacha process was basically resurrecting an ancient court process, a community court process, in fact. And it enabled an enormous number of people to be processed after the genocide. And communities basically were asked to hear out the perpetrators. And very, very horrible stories, as you can imagine, were heard en masse on a weekly basis in Rwanda for several years. And eventually, those who confessed were either given time in prison and then later released or given prison time. And there are some who still serve prison time, but the vast majority have been released. While it's a much criticized process, the view on the ground is I don't think anyone could have come up with anything better, you know, given the immensity of the crimes and the overall number of people who were actually involved. I actually have friends who served in the gachacha process, and they had extraordinary experiences, and feel that overall it was an extremely fair and just process.
So, Josh Ruxin, you mentioned I know you're at the airport about to go to Kigali, and your wife is there, and she owns a restaurant at which Samantha Power, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, who's representing the U.S. in these ceremonies that go on for a week, starting on Monday in Rwanda, to officially mourn and commemorate the 20th anniversary of these massacres. Tell me about the restaurant. Tell me about what it's like doing business there and in general, what you're trying to do in terms of, I take it you're trying to encourage local entrepreneurs. Is that what you're trying to do?
Absolutely. And just to take a step back, and this is all documented in a book that I recently published called A Thousand Hills to Heaven. And it's really a book about my wife and our experiences raising a family and starting this restaurant in Rwanda, and also the public health work that I've done. Rwanda is very much a place that's open for business. It's highly transparent. We've never faced corruption in setting up a business. Anyone can set up a business within about 24 hours in Rwanda. And I think the great challenges are that it's a new country. Such a high percentage of the population was born just in the last 20 years, and they aren't necessarily exposed to international service standards. So we go to great lengths to invest in our employees, to invest in our team, so that they can deliver a first-rate experience, not just by Rwandan standards, but by any.
So what are these reports then we hear, and particularly in terms of those that the French, for example, who are outraged at the remarks by Paul Kagame for accusing them and the Belgians for being complicit in the massacre. And there is evidence that Tutsis who'd escaped to safe areas under the French military control were massacred. So there's clearly still some reckoning to be done there. But Kagame himself has something of a reputation of being authoritarian. So give me a sense of if you have a country there where there isn't any corruption, which is very unusual in Africa, what's the disconnect then between his authoritarianism and lack of corruption?
Oftentimes I will turn to wiser souls like our staff at Heaven. There's a guy named John who's our head of service. And when I ask him, you know, whether he feels as though his liberties are impaired by authoritarianism, he just laughs and says, you know, most Rwandans feel freer than they ever have in the course of their lives or their parents' or grandparents' lives, free to set up business, free to go to school, free to walk the streets at night without living in fear, free to do whatever they want. And so I think that an insider's view of Rwanda looks dramatically different from the character by the outside.
Well, just in closing then, Josh Ruxin, given that there's so much guilt around the world, which the head of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, expressed and was quite remorseful. Samantha Power, of course, as we mentioned, wrote a book about the US's failure. Bill Clinton, apparently, and Al Gore both feel a residual guilt. And Susan Rice, who's the head of the National Security Council, who was on the Africa desk at the State Department at the time, she also feels remorse and has spoken about it. So how is this remorse translated then into anything real on the ground? Because, you know, we've mentioned the ongoing horrors in the Congo where about 8 million people have died and nobody seems to give a damn, yet everybody quite justifiably are appalled about what's happening in Syria. But there is generally a feeling here of a double standard that Africans can die in large numbers anonymously, and if a few Europeans and others die, we seem to be much more concerned.
You know, there's an incredible amount of hand-wringing and remorse that's displayed, but I don't see it translating into any outsized levels of aid or investment. And, you know, the Rwandans are very clear about how they feel about it, which is you abandoned us then, but today we have great opportunity, and if you want to do something for us, don't give us just traditional aid. Bring business. Come and visit as a tourist. Spend money here. Help us improve our national treasures. Help us improve our overall country, our education, our infrastructure. You know, help us with the things that are going to be sustained in the long run. I mean, one thing that the government of Rwanda has gone on the record many times as saying is that they don't want to be a donor recipient nation 15, 20 years from now. That's incredible ambition, and you can't even find far wealthier nations in Africa who would ever reach a statement. And I think this comes out of the genocide. When you see that relying on the outside doesn't necessarily get you anywhere, you change tactics and you change strategy and you improve and realize that the best way to get a hand up is to have private investment and to create a level playing field where investors do want to put their dollars. And we're seeing this in Rwanda. They've actually floated a couple of bonds very successfully, an extraordinary achievement for a little landlocked country. I think that Rwanda is really on the right track. Going back to your comment about Congo, I also believe that a good, strong Rwanda is probably good for the region. It does provide general geopolitical stability. And I think that the more that Rwanda and Eastern Congo can engage, the better. I mean, a stable Eastern Congo is actually very good for the Rwandan economy. So I think everybody has got a shared view of that. The problem is that there is absolutely no government structure per se in Eastern Congo. So you just cross the border into Rwanda, you see the streets are clean, you see that there isn't the chaos, you see that the health system is actually functioning, there's a national health insurance policy and program that is that covers over 90% of the population. It's stunning the difference that a strong government that actually cares about its people can make in the lives of its citizens. And that's why I'm living in Rwanda, and that's why I'm flying back home there.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Josh Ruxin.
Thank you.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.